Hi, and welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Simon Smart.
We're speaking with Daryl Bock, who's a professor of New Testament studies at Dallas Theological Seminary. He's done a lot of work on the historical Jesus and the reliability of the Bible text, and has written more than 30 books on biblical topics, including the popular Breaking the Da Vinci Code, which investigated the claims that Dan Brown's book made about Jesus and the history of the church. He's well equipped then to shed some light on today's topic, which is Jesus, the Bible, and conspiracy theories. Welcome to the program, all the way from Texas.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here and any time to look at conspiracies.
So, Daryl, you're a Bible scholar and a Christian. You spend a lot of time thinking about how the Bible's put together and how trustworthy it is, whether we can trust its account of who Jesus is. I'm guessing that you try to keep up with the various challenges to the Christian view of Jesus. So do you find these recurrent challenges energizing, frustrating?
They're in some ways fascinating. It's interesting to see how the same stuff kind of gets respun in many ways, because most of what you see, you've actually seen before, and it's being repackaged or taken from a slightly different angle. But the basic challenges really haven't changed very much in the time that I've been teaching.
Nothing new under the sun.
Not quite so new. Now the sun just keeps shining.
So one recent one has been Reza Aslan's book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. So Aslan is a professor of religion and of creative writing at the University of California. Can you tell us, what's his Jesus like, and how plausible a figure do you think he is?
Well, this is a book that tries to portray Jesus very much in political terms and is very selective about what it picks in drawing that portrait. And there certainly are political aspects to what it is that Jesus did and sociological aspects to what Jesus did. But it's a very typical book in really stepping back from the more theological aspects of Jesus' teaching and claims. And in that way, it attempts to, I think, neutralize Jesus to some degree and step back from the uniqueness of what it is that he was doing.
Now, Daryl, an even more recent example was Bart Ehrman's book, How Jesus Became God. Now, Bart Ehrman's a well-known professor of religious studies at the University of Carolina. I know you've engaged with him before. And the idea in this book is that Jesus didn't think he was God, that was really something that got cooked up later by his followers sometime down the track. And this is a common idea, but how widely is it accepted among scholars?
Well, there are some scholars who accept this idea. Again, I think that what you often see among scholars is an attempt to keep a respectable Jesus, who's a historical figure, but to somehow step back from the uniqueness of the way he's framed in the Christian documents. And so there's an attempt to divide something that very much belongs together. So we'll get Jesus being a prophet. Yeah, we can do that. There are lots of prophets around, Elijah, Moses, they were prophets, that kind of thing. Jesus a Messiah? Maybe. Some will say yes, some will say no. Jesus Son of God? No way, that's too unique a claim. And so the higher up the Christological scale you go, the higher up the skepticism comes in. Because if you get a Jesus who is unique, then you have to deal with the unique claims of Christianity. So it becomes culturally acceptable, I think, to try and keep a respect for Jesus, but not too much respect, so that he becomes a religious leader like other religions, and it's an attempt to lower the profile of Christianity.
Okay, so this is something you would contest, of course, but how much of a challenge is this attempt by Ehrman to bring up what's not a new idea, is it?
No, and Ehrman will often say, he's not saying anything different than what many scholars are saying. He represents a wing of the conversation that takes place about the New Testament and scholarship. What's frustrating about his books in many ways is that it is very much a one-sided argument. You're only getting one half of the story. You're not getting how people deal with the issues that he raises in incredible kinds of ways. He's kind of dismissive of the responses that come back and say, no, there's a way to put this together that's very different than the way you're doing it.
Okay, well, let's look at another one, a very popular topic, the one of Jesus' wife. The most recent kind of scandal around this was when a Harvard professor wrote about a papyrus fragment that had been found where Jesus was recorded as beginning a sentence with the words, My Wife. Now, in May of this year, this was shown to be a hoax. Can you comment on the phenomenon, though, the Jesus Wife conspiracy theory, which is also part of the Da Vinci Code? You know something about that.
I'm not sure I'm quite to the point of saying this is absolutely proven to be a hoax. I think there's a lot of doubt about it. The actual scientific data about the date of the papyrus and the date of the writing makes it a later text than it was earlier purported to be. There's still debate about whether it's a genuine ancient text or whether someone has completely fabricated it, and there's evidence really going both ways on that question. Nonetheless, the idea that even if you have a somewhat ancient authentic text, you have phenomena in Gnostic Christianity that can explain this without being evidence of the fact that Jesus was actually married. In principle, I don't have any problem with the idea of Jesus being married, but there's just no evidence for it. And one of the great indications of this is when this story originally broke in relationship to the Da Vinci Code book, rather, and then my response breaking the Da Vinci Code, I was asked at the time by a website, a prominent website, to write an article on whether I thought Jesus was married, and they asked John Dominic Crossan to also write on the same topic. Now, Crossan and I come from about as opposite a set of the spectrum on historical Jesus as anybody, but on this one we agreed. And I used to say to my classes, when you can get a conservative and a skeptic liberal to agree about something, then the chances are pretty good that's where things lie.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith. We're speaking to Professor Daryl Bock about challenges to the Bible's account of Jesus. Daryl, what do you think it is about these kinds of theories? So some of them are almost bordering on conspiracy theories, that's so appealing to people. Why do people want to believe that there's something that's been hidden all these years and we've just found it out?
Well, I think there are two elements to it. One is that people just like mysteries. Mysteries are really cool, you know, and to know something that someone else doesn't and have it be discovered is really nice. And so in that sense, they're intriguing. They become intriguing. It's easy to develop a hype around them. But then the second feature is the one I've already mentioned earlier, and that is there's an attempt to communicate a regard for Jesus and a cultural respect for Jesus, but an acceptable cultural respect that will keep you out of all the difficult questions that a unique Christianity would pose to a society. And so it's a safe place to put Christianity, to have Jesus be this, if I can say, controllable Messiah figure. And so what you see is an attempt to reduce who Jesus is as a way of avoiding a whole series of questions that one must face if the claims associated with him are even reasonably close to being true.
So you have a book coming out in September called Truth in a Culture of Doubt, Engaging Skeptical Challenges to the Bible. One of the things that you address in that book is the question of contradictions within Scripture. You hear people say this a lot, that the Bible is just full of contradictions. How do you respond to that objection?
Well, in one sense, you've got to almost respond one case at a time as opposed to a generic thing. But what you often see skeptics do is say, difference equals contradiction. And what I like to say to people is difference doesn't necessarily equal contradiction. It may represent editorial choice. It may represent the difference between a summarization and a very precise account. There are all kinds of things that can go on in differences between accounts. And I like to illustrate this by saying, if you ask my wife and me about our courtship, there will be certain things that will come up that will be very similar. There will be certain things that she'll talk about and notice and tell you about that didn't even register on my story screen because I just wasn't concerned about those types of things, and vice versa. And if you go to put our two stories together without talking to us both at the same time simultaneously, you will have all these contradictions in our story. But I'm still quite married to my wife, who I deeply love, who I was engaged with the courtship, and who we did eventually get together. And the core story of our life is quite obviously bound together in ways that courtship story would reveal.
Now, Daryl, there's obviously a lot of skepticism towards the biblical text and the claim that it makes about Jesus, but it's fair to say, isn't it, that if we want to get at what the Bible's really saying and what it has to offer us, you do have to approach this material with at least some degree of open-mindedness, don't you? And what's the sort of advice you give to people, skeptics or otherwise, as they approach this text?
Well, I think the hardest thing about the Bible are the claims that it has that God is very active in the world and did unusual things. And so I often say, if you don't believe that God can act in his creation, and if you don't believe that there's the possibility of things like miracles, the Bible is going to give you headaches. I mean, it just is. And you're going to see efforts to try and explain how you get what we have without accepting what you have in the text. And so part of this openness has to be to the possibility that God may actually have worked in lives of people in special ways, in surprising ways, and being open to that. And actually, there's a lot of good historical evidence for thinking about those kinds of things, because people took on all kinds of really heroic kinds of dedication in the midst of responding to what was going on. And we even have testimony from coming outside Christianity with regard to Jesus about the kind of unusual works that he performed, that kind of thing. So there are sand prints in the ground for God having walked with us.
I mean, you'd be well aware of this, but one of the things that I think keeps me a believer is this sense that the Bible has been sort of picked to pieces over hundreds and hundreds of years, and yet still stands as a solid, reliable entity with something to say. And it's the thing that often keeps me in there. But is it? Do you have some connection with that or resonance with that as someone who's had to do very deep study of the actual text?
Yeah, I think that oftentimes what people will say, what people will hear from Christians, is it's true because it's in the Bible. And I prefer to reverse that. I think it's in the Bible because it's true. I think if you look at how humanity is described, the honesty with which humanity is described, the honesty of the mess and the turmoil that's in our fallen world, as we say it theologically, but what people say on the street is, the world's a mess. And it's actually saying the same thing in a different non-theological way, but it's a quite theological observation. And then you look at how the Bible explains how people abuse and misuse one another and how they can pursue God and a respect for one another that's healthy, and you take the best of what the Bible has to offer, it really sheds a light on reality in a way that I think other works do not.
Thinking more broadly about skepticism and challenges to faith, are there any significant challenges that you could tell us about that you've faced in your faith over the years, and how have you come to terms with them, if so?
I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I was very much an agnostic growing up, but I wasn't so much of an agnostic that I couldn't get nervous about certain situations in life. And the best story I like to tell is when I went to college to get a potluck roommate. Now, a potluck roommate in college in America means you're going to be living with someone for a year that the university picks out for you, as opposed to you selecting who you're going to live with for a year. It's a little bit like getting married without an engagement. And so in that sense, I was an agnostic at the time, and I prayed this prayer: God, I don't know if you exist, but if you do, please give me anybody but a Bible-carrying Southern Baptist for my roommate, because I want to enjoy my college years. Amen. That was literally the whole prayer. Well, when I got to SMU and opened the door, there was a Bible sitting on this trunk. My roommate wasn't in the room yet, but his name was Doug Mickey. He was from Atlanta, Georgia. That's from the South. And I didn't have to ask his denomination, because actually what I discovered later is he was Doug Mickey, and he had attended the First Baptist Church of Atlanta, Georgia. And he was definitely a Bible-carrying Southern Baptist. And I learned the answer to the question, does God answer the prayer of unbelievers? The answer is definitely yes. He answered mine by answering it definitely no. And so in that sense, what we see is God's engagement with our lives. And what I came to appreciate is what Christians were telling me about how life works and the way God interacts with us in the creation, I actually saw in something that God did in the midst of my life when I was in the midst of skepticism and doubt, to assure me that he was very interested in drawing me to himself.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that story. Wonderful to have your expertise on these issues, Daryl. So thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure as always.
We've been speaking with Professor Daryl Bock from Dallas Theological Seminary. For more interviews with Daryl, and for our other material, you can head to our website at publicchristianity.org. See you next week.